Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
I have got my fist, I've got my plan, I've got survivalism, and that is really the extent of my musical knowledge today on Double Feature.
Alright.
My name is Eric, I'm here with Michael, who has more knowledge about the music than I do. Turns out there's more than one band
yeah.
in existence.
Yeah, that's...
See, my mind was blown when I found out about Saul Williams, because then there were two bands that existed. The Unspoken First Band, which I'm no longer allowed to ramble about on the podcast, and Saul Williams, but it turns out there's other bands, and they have made films.
Mm-hmm.
What are the films we're talking
about? The films we're talking about today are Detroit Rock City and Christmas on Mars.
So I'm going to apologize and then also tell the audience to fuck themselves in one swift blow right
here. All right, here we go.
All right, so here's what's happening. We're going to talk about two musical movies. We thought we'd stick them right together, because there's not anything we're really going to be able to pair Detroit Rock City with and actually talk about the production angle and that make any sense. And we have the same problem with Christmas on Mars. It's a film that actually I think we could probably pair Christmas on Mars with stuff, but we'd have to put it with some sci-fi things that are really, really culty, like a THX kind
right.
of thing, you know, old school George Lucas or a Kubrick thing. And that's just not fair at all.
Not at all.
If you don't care about Kiss or the Flaming Lips, you might be a little bit lost on this show, especially Kiss, because
right.
Detroit Rock City is Kiss.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about the Flaming Lips, and I enjoyed the hell out of Christmas on Mars. Just saw it for the first time, loved it. So I think there's a lot to that. But if you don't know anything about either of those bands, and especially the musical elements of the
right.
movies don't interest you, you might not be into the show today.
We'll see. We'll try to keep the music stuff as pulled back as possible, but
sure.
honestly, when you're talking about these two films,
you
that's
have to.
What's going
to
come
You have
up.
To cover it. We'll talk a lot about the usual film nonsense
yeah.
that people tune
into. The stuff
into
that people tune
for.
Into that even we don't really care about.
We have to care. It's where our heart is. So next time, this is where the apology / middle finger thing comes in. I'm not really sure what part of what I just said is
an apology.
Apology or middle finger. It's one or the other. But next time we are doing Killapalooza number 9. Now, people have been writing us in with Killapalooza ideas, thinking that we forgot one that was really obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about the Romero stuff.
Yeah.
One day we'll do it, but here's the problem. Too much zombies.
Too much zombies.
We just need to back away from the zombies for a while. And when society forgets about zombies, we'll pull the Romero stuff out and take a look at it. That's not what we're doing. There's another one that's extremely obvious.
Right.
Did we miss this? What happened?
So what ended up happening is we covered in the first year who I consider almost every single iconic figurehead in slasherdom.
Jason, Freddy, Child's Play stuff, we got it all.
Absolutely. Except we skipped one. And it's not because we wanted to skip it, it's because we only had time for 5 Killapaloozas.
Right, and that important icon was Children of the Corn, and then
no,
we covered
that's
it.
Not
so what
true.
Was left?
So what ended up happening is we decided that with this last icon, we'd wait till the end of this year. Because why, if we start off with the best one, then everybody's going to be annoyed when we do Children of the Corn, when we do Leprechaun.
Right.
So we're going to do Hellraiser.
Turns out they were already annoyed, but yes, Hellraiser. Sorry
Hellraiser next week.
Yeah, so we got Hellraiser coming up. So here's the deal. If you're listening to this, it's not interesting you, fuck it, you don't have to hear every show. Go watch some Hellraiser movies and then come back, because we know you haven't even started doing that
right.
yet.
And there's 8.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. So just go get started watching those movies. They'll provide you with more than enough entertainment to make up for our show. I was kind of hoping that would be the middle finger part of that, but that sounded more like the apology part.
I guess they're both kind of the same thing.
We have some chapters embedded in the feed of
yeah.
the show, embedded in the show, the very show itself. So you can go on iTunes, you can go in QuickTime, you can use your iPhone or iPad or whatever you want to use to just skip right from Detroit Rock City to Christmas on Mars or to the end of the show. So you know what? If you make it most of the way through Detroit Rock City and you decide too much Kiss, you can go to Christmas on Mars and then you can decide too many vaginas and go back to Detroit Rock City. You can do whatever you want with this show. There's going to be spoilers about the movies as well, I guess.
If they're spoilable, it'll be spoiled. That's how we roll.
Let's talk about this movie called Kiss. Is that what it's called?
It's called Detroit Rock City,
of
but the alternate title is, of course, The Kiss Movie.
Okay.
So Detroit Rock City is this film. It came out in 2001. It didn't come out in the 90s. It didn't come out in 1977. It came out in 2001, and it's this Kiss-produced... It's an hour and a half long Kiss commercial.
Yeah.
Is essentially what happened here. It was produced by Gene Simmons and Tim Sullivan. And Tim Sullivan, we've seen earlier on the show, he directed 2001 Maniac.
Yeah.
And a lot of the cast of Detroit Rock City ended up falling into 2001 Maniacs and another film that we've seen on the show.
Another one.
Do you remember we did this film by Eli Roth called...
I know exactly where you're going with this.
Cabin Fever.
Yes.
A lot of the
cast... That was a long time ago.
A lot of the cast of Detroit Rock City was borrowed for Cabin Fever because of Eli Roth's fanship of Tim Sullivan's production.
Sure.
And then Tim Sullivan himself directed 2001 Maniacs, where we saw Lynn Shay, who's the mother in Detroit Rock City. But a lot of Tim Sullivan's hand in here is what makes the film so good for me.
Mm.
Eli Roth obviously borrowed James DeBello, who plays Trip, and he borrowed Giuseppe Andrews, who is Winston in Cabin Fever, plays Lex in Detroit Rock City. And then we have another player who kind of ends
seen on the show before.
Yeah, he ends up playing what seems to be the lead role in the film. He's the band leader.
Yeah.
He's not the lead role in the film.
He's
in fact,
the shy band leader.
He has the smallest character arc of anybody in the entire film.
And also the shortest period for ejaculation.
Yes, that's
true. Edward Furlong.
Edward Furlong, who we've seen from Terminator 2 as young John Connor.
So with a cast like this, do you see some horror stuff in the film?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because like you pick up some of that. It's almost unavoidable.
Yeah. Well, I wanna attribute that to Tim Sullivan. Obviously, I don't know for sure, but this guy's horror. I mean, that's his thing.
Yeah.
Where he came from, it's where he's going. There's a lot of really interesting and dark scenes that happen. The one that always stands out for me right away is the scene in the school hallway where Lynn Shay, the mom, burns the KISS tickets.
Right, right.
And Jam turns the corner and she's down at the end of the hallway and there's a huge dark score swell and a vertigo and you just see this dark shadowy figure covering her face with the one thing these boys love in the entire world.
And then lighting the cigarette and burning the tickets is probably one of the most memorable images of the whole film.
Oh, sure. And then that culminates with the tickets in the ashtray with the operatic score screaming over these tickets.
Operatic
on
score
fire.
Is screaming over the entire film.
It's amazing. That's true.
Yeah. Every time something, you know, these triumphant moments or these, you know, being taken to the boarding home, essentially. Pulling up to that gate, everything just sort of screams this. It's almost satirical.
Yeah.
It's definitely drawing from, you know, old monster movie kind of stuff.
Sure.
Dun, dun, dun. Sure. You know, it's this these moments where you're kind of laughing at what's happening. I don't think it's too... It's overwhelming, but I think that's completely intentional.
Right. Well, yeah, it's the whole purpose of the film is to make you feel like you're in the 70s.
Right.
Make you feel like
feel Kiss, the drama of teenagers.
Right, make you feel like Kiss still matters.
Sure, sure.
Because honestly, in 2001, Kiss wasn't doing shit.
No.
So a little background on this band called Kiss.
Yes.
In the late 60s, these four Jewish guys decided that they were going to make a ton of money. They all changed their name to sound more rock and roll. Peter Crisola became Peter Chris. Paul Frehley became Ace Frehley, the space ace. And then they all painted up their faces. They gave themselves weird stage names like the Catman and the Demon.
Okay.
And then they decided to write what at the time was some of the scariest, most corrupt, subversive music known to mankind.
I don't believe you.
That's actually a fact.
Okay.
Kiss is formed completely out of commercial success. They were not, honestly, one or two members, maybe. really cared about the music.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Simmons is not one of those members.
No.
Gene Simmons is Mr. Dollar Sign for Kiss. And since Kiss began, nothing but Kiss merchandise has been pushed by these men.
Right.
Whether it be lunchboxes, backpacks, suspenders, belt buckle. I mean, they cover some of it. There's wallets, there's a belt. Stuff like that just started popping up everywhere.
It's merchandising. It's their get-rich-quick scheme.
Absolutely. And Gene Simmons has been quoted to say, he says something along the lines of, I wanted to make sure that any kid who wanted to could go to school, have a Kiss lunchbox inside their Kiss backpack with their Kiss shirt on. It's just this thing. I mean, they become, the fans of Kiss turn into Kiss advertisements.
Yeah, they do. They're walking billboards.
That's what happens. Sure. And that's the beauty of the band, because if you look interesting right off the bat, paint your fucking face.
Right.
People don't care about the music right off. They see the name Kiss in Knights in Satan Service lighting.
Yeah, right.
And immediately people go, this is something I'm at least interested in, even though they're, for some reason, the two camps of thought in the 70s were Kiss is so badass, scary, and evil, or Kiss is gay, they wear makeup.
What's not rock and roll about that? I mean, it almost sounds cynical when we talk about it, but the idea of, you know how I'm going to make it in life? I'm going to start a band. And you're going to merchandise the fuck out of the band, and people are going to live it, really. I think that's, you know, that's essentially rock and roll. That's quit your day job. That's fuck the man.
Right. And this film is no stranger to that fact.
No, not at all.
This film, as we said before, it's just, it's a 90 minute infomercial for Kiss. It's made by Kiss. It's a paid, it's the following is a paid advertisement sponsored by Kiss.
Sure. I got in an argument the other day with somebody about it where we were talking about the fact that the movie did not gross as much money as it cost to make. And I couldn't get the point across that it doesn't matter if you spent, you know, $14 million on posters for Kiss, you gross back $0. It's an advertising expense.
Right, exactly.
That's what the movie is. They made it, and it's a huge advertisement for the band.
And it works.
Yes, it did.
So that's actually, that's a fact for me. I wasn't into Kiss at all. I took
No, I was wondering where this came from, and then you told me about 2001 Maniacs.
So yeah, essentially what happened is I was following producers and following Giuseppe Andrews, as I do in my free time as well.
What the fuck does a producer do? Issue you a restraining order.
So I was watching Detroit Rock City.
It's hard. I have to play your role in this show.
Right.
All right.
Sorry. So I was watching Detroit Rock City and, again, having no interest in Kiss whatsoever.
Sure.
Two facts about Detroit Rock City. You watch it one time and you become interested in Kiss. Maybe not a fan.
Sure.
But you become interested. I became a fan, a huge fan, by the end of the movie because it pulled it off and it made me think Kiss was the greatest thing ever for just long enough for me to get a greatest hits, and that's all you need.
Yeah.
Second thing, it's better if you're a Kiss fan. A lot of the jokes in the film are just really subtle. It's songs that play in the background. For example, when they're in the room where the chick is, where they knock the stalls over.
Right.
There's a Kiss song called Ladies Room playing, which seems really contrived when I'm actually explaining it to you. But it's really funny because it's subtle to a normal person who is just a fan of the music and doesn't have to explain it.
All right. So now that people know how the dynamic of the jokes work, why don't we try a little experiment for anyone who really wants to do this? Because you were able to give me a quick Kiss primer so I could enjoy the what became blatantly obvious jokes at that point. Why don't you just list off some, let's call them random Kiss trivia facts that may or may not help you you want to pause our show and then go quickly watch Detroit Rock City as if you got all of the jokes for yourself and then come back to the show.
Okay, so the most important things that, as I'm just going to pick some random facts.
Sure, completely random.
The Kiss fan club at the time, and now even, but really heavily in the 70s, was called the Kiss Army because they were evil. They were, as the mother, I love the name, I love when the mother calls them Knights in Satan's Service.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though their name is Kiss, it's not it's not an acronym for anything.
Yeah.
But they have this, they're the Kiss Army. That's the fan club. That's everybody liked Kiss. They were part of this.
Fans of the band. Got it. What else?
Another thing is that this weird anomaly in the 70s happened where the drummer of Kiss, Peter Criss, the Catman, wrote one song that ever became popular.
Should the Catman, that title, make me as uncomfortable as it does?
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, great.
He wrote one song and it was this really girly tune called Beth.
Okay.
It's just a piano ballad about how he wants to see his girlfriend, but he's busy practicing music with the boys.
Sounds like a surefire hit.
So that was the drummer of the band, in case you didn't catch that.
All right.
The third thing that, just random fact, Kiss has another song with a girl's name in it called Christine 16. It's about a girl that you want to have sex with, but you can't have sex with because she's too young.
Okay.
Those are just some random Kiss facts.
Pause, watch Detroit Rock City, come back.
So there's one thing that happens in this film that I'm going to actually bounce off of you. Are you ready to actually contribute a little more?
I've got it. I'm going to wake up a little bit over here, put down my Trent Reznor scrapbook, and let's go.
All right. So in this film, they go to Detroit Rock City. This is not a stupid joke. There's a Kiss song called Detroit Rock City.
Oh, I see.
That's where the title came from.
Got it.
So they go to Detroit for this massive Kiss show. This is Kiss in their prime.
Sure.
This is the Love Gun Kiss. And they go to Detroit and the city's fucking shut down.
Mm-hmm.
You can't walk. You can't drive. All these stores are just packed full of people wearing Kiss billboards on their shirts.
Right, right.
I just want to know if you think that that was something that Gene Simmons and the boys kind of cooked up to make Kiss seem like a really big fucking deal.
Sure.
Or if you think that,
or if it actually happened.
If that's how things used to be in the 70s.
If it's true to life. I guess just judging by the tone of the film, it has to be a little theatrical. But I don't know. You know, I went to that awful festival that we named our Killapaloozas after. I think you can figure that one out for yourself. If not, it's a festival that happens in Chicago, so fucking try harder with your Google over there.
Jazz Fest.
Oh, God. No, I wish I went to the Jazz Fest. Jesus, fuck. Anyways, it was kind of a big deal down there. I mean, at least down there, they had streets shut down. You know, the festival is fucking huge, but everybody walking around the loop downtown. It happened in, what, Millennium Park, Grand Park, down there. Sure. Somewhere. You couldn't tell because it was fucking all over the place. But if you left the concert to go to a sandwich shop, a fucking Subway or something outside, you would see people decked out like they were clearly coming from the concert. You know, it's like any other giant festival. I mean, this, we're talking about a Kiss concert where actually it's just Kiss. There's no opening band and they only play one song.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. Of course, I don't think it would create that much fanfare. But yeah, it's possible that that was a part of, well, we weren't born in the 70s.
Right.
We don't know anything, but you know more about the 70s than me, so I don't really know.
I'm sure there's some fans of ours that are from the 70s. If you know the answer to this, if you can actually provide some legitimate insight one way or the other, email us, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. We're not going to call you old. In fact, I'm going to really like you because I'm a big 70s fan. So that means that by proxy, I'm a big fan of you.
But I mean, when I go to a concert, and I go to so few concerts probably because I burn myself out on this, I have to go at 6 a.m.
Right.
I have to be the first stupid fucking person in line. And I really like, you know, the line forming behind you. You get to meet everybody who's going to the concert. And even if the concert is for a smaller band, it ends up being a giant collection of like-minded people. It mm-hmm. is a fucking event. Maybe not this big, but I think they captured the essence of what that is.
Right.
Also, Hail Satan.
Yeah, apparently. So the other thing that goes on in the middle of Detroit while this concert is about to give way, there's what are they called? Matmock, Mothers Against the Music of Kiss.
That is the worst acronym.
It's horrible.
Of all time.
It's absolutely horrible. But the thing that's weird is that, again, I don't know if this really happened. I'm inclined to believe this is more legitimate than the city of Detroit shutting down for a Kiss show.
Well, I don't know if that particular organization existed, but yeah, there were actual protests
picketing,
against Kiss. Yeah,
picketing the show. There's, for some reason, I don't understand it now because I live in 2010, where I could be listening to Insane Clown Posse, I could be listening to, I don't even know, I don't, honestly, I don't find any music controversial.
Yeah, well, look at the films we do on the show.
Right, so I'm sure there's some really controversial music that either I don't know about.
Music gets controversial in weird layers. I've mentioned Mindless Self-Indulgence a couple times on the show. That's a band that appears controversial, but then people don't actually think they're controversial, but then the fact that they might be doing it as a joke to those people becomes another layer of controversy. So I think, you know, music became such a controversial thing, rock music, in the mm-hmm. 70s, that by this time it's almost beyond this layer of performance art.
Right. So apparently Kiss is the devil's music, and backwards it spells sick, if you didn't notice that.
Oh, okay.
But what I don't understand is that, honestly, by today's standards, Kiss music is tame.
Yeah.
It's really tame.
Yeah.
It's more tame than anything on the radio.
It's in Dr. Pepper commercials.
Absolutely. And at the time, it was the devil's music. They were... Again, I'm going to keep bringing it up. They were the knights in Satan's service.
Yeah.
I don't understand why Kiss could ever... They never... Even the songs, I can't imagine what was subversive. They're just about having a good time. They're about rocking and rolling all night. I mean, come on.
Well, there was a time where dancing was subversive.
Apparently,
so,
that's true.
I mean, humanity does evolve. This, for me, is just another one of these great double feature humanist experiences where I can look back at the 70s, think rock and roll was subversive. Look how far we have come as a species. Just when you get down about personal liberties, you know, these things that look like they're in crisis mode right now, you just think back to how bad it used to be. And I think part of that is not to just blame religion for everything on the show, but the film would at least have you believe that religion is to be made fun of, if not part of the reason there is a problem. I mean, when the drummer gets on the stage and bitches out
his
mom,
that's such a good scene,
it's
too.
It's over her using religion as this sort of barrier between the two of them, as an excuse for being the tyrant in his life.
Right.
I mean, there's different levels of religious commentary if you want to go all the way to the Jonestown stuff.
Yeah, that's in there.
Which we should really cover on this show. It's almost a Waco-like.
Sure.
Maybe we'll find a documentary about it and talk, because it deserves its own conversation. Mm-hmm. It's too much of a tangent.
Absolutely.
But then there's the stuff in the confessional where
they're
making fun of everything that's going on with a Catholic priest, which was a big 10 years ago. I mean, that was a huge story that was breaking. And to kind of have the ability to look back in the 70s where it wasn't as breaking of a story, but still obviously fucking happening, is an interesting vantage point you have. There's other weird taboos, too. You know, the older women propositioning the underage boy.
That's Gene Simmons' girlfriend, actually.
Yeah, but which is weird because, you know, and I think this is still the case today, but that's okay. Older woman propositioning underage boy, that's rock and roll.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's beyond okay. That's fucking hot.
Yeah,
that's
what that's supposed to be, right? But older man propositioning underage girl,
that's illegal. Prison time right there.
In Detroit Rock City, there would have been the sound of the needle scraping off the record as if this was some Rob Schneider trailer, and everything would get really dark and serious, and it would be a fucked up moment. But older woman propositioning younger boy, rock and roll, man.
Yeah.
If you didn't detect the sarcasm in that, that's fucked up, yeah, by the way, is what stupid. I was getting at.
Okay.
Double standard. Awful.
Just making sure. So aside from the devil side of Kiss, the other thing that they have is a cult following. That wasn't true in the 70s. In the 70s, they had an actual following.
Right.
Now it's a cult following.
So how would you differentiate the two of those? Because we talk about cult following all the time. What's the difference between a cult following and a following?
Well, in the 70s, Kiss was one of the biggest bands in the country. They were popular. People were proud to love Kiss. I mean, obviously, there was the disco scene that was kind of forming.
Sure. And we see the sort of disco versus rock.
The Stella Guido scenes.
Yeah.
So in the 70s, Kiss was very popular. People were okay liking them. Now, in the 2Ks, most of the people that were fans of Kiss in the 70s either forgot or they're the type of people that don't go around parading their musical taste because they're in their 30s and 40s now.
Right.
Also, people who are newly getting into Kiss, part of them are afraid to mention loving Kiss.
Right, yeah.
Because Kiss it's cheesy now. It's corny as hell.
Yeah.
So now it's just kind of this thing where people all really enjoy Kiss, but they like it for a novel reason.
Sure.
It's not because they think they're a badass rock band. It's because they think they're a badass rock band.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's this removal from what Kiss used to be and this admiration for what they once were that make people love them. And that's what the film is all about.
Well, and Double Feature is now almost the third wave of that. Mm-hmm. We have Kiss in the 70s. 2001 is Detroit Rock City, this revitalization of the Kiss army, of the Kiss fan base as a cult movement. And then everyone forgot about Detroit Rock City. So here we are in 2010 talking about it again. And at least three or four individuals will go download some Kiss as a result of this.
Yeah.
So you think the cult fan base is just a matter of how many people there are, really?
Well, not only that, but I think it's part of where the affection lies. They're kind of looking at it in a satirical way, but in an adoring fashion.
Sure.
Where they love Kiss, but they love them because they're cute and novel.
Right. Well, it's also a matter of, Kiss isn't exactly getting radio play today. Mm-hmm. If they are, it's for that reason. But having a smaller fan base that is just as diehard, I think the actual Kiss fan base was diehard, but sure. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive to have a huge fan base and a cult fan base at the same time.
Right.
I think that's one of the things that was interesting about what was almost a movement of Kiss fans in the 70s is you had a lot of people who liked Kiss and then a pretty large segment of them who were also what you would consider by today's standards a cult fan base.
Absolutely.
So today you have that remaining core of the cult fan base, which was probably the most important part of that.
And that's what the film touches on so heavily. The film is produced to be a cult film.
Mm-hmm.
It's built like a collection of short vignettes that are designed in such a way that you can dictate what scene you're talking about by saying one thing.
They're very memorable.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're all very distinct.
Sure.
And all the characters are very enjoyable and you can latch on to every single one. They all have their own story arc. So if you're not interested in Tripp's character, you can be excited when Giuseppe Andrews sicks the dogs on the mechanics, which is one of my favorite scenes.
Well, you can talk about the film by using the phrase, the scene where.
Right, exactly.
And there is a lot of scenes where, the scene where the tickets burn, the scene where they win the radio contest, The pizza scene, exactly. When the four of them split up, they all have their own scenes. In fact, a couple of them have several scenes. It just makes it more accessible as a cult film.
Well, I think part of that is because you get to divide the characters. You get to see them in individual situations, and each of them has a very strong story arc. Again, with the exception of Hawk, Edward Furlong's character, who kind of remains stationary because he's the leader. He's the core force to... His goal is the Kiss concert. Everybody else kind of has separate goals. Lex wants to find the car. Jam needs to hook up with Beth. Trip's burnt out, and he tries to rob a store, and he has to grapple with himself as to whether or not that his Stretch Armstrong is going to successfully rob the store.
But you remember the scene where they're in the car, and they're talking about how they can't perform as a cover band.
Right.
They're in a cover band, by the way. I don't think we've mentioned that once so far. Maybe at the very beginning. You remember the scene where they're in the car, and they're talking about how they can't perform because their band leader is so shy.
Yeah.
And he ends up being the one who has to take his pants off.
Right.
I think there's a pretty clear story out
there. That's true. Yeah, that's a good point. I always kind of forget that the stage fright thing happened because it's so passing in the car and everybody's so high. But that's what the film's all about. It's about this cult thing. It's about Kiss trying to advertise themselves. And I know this is Double Feature. This is a film show and we just talked for what seems like 30 minutes about Kiss. But in reality, we were talking about the power of production.
Yes.
And a film. And
it all comes back to the producers.
What can be done with a film when you put the right minds behind it and the right goals in front of it.
Hopefully we've inspired our listeners to go create their own propaganda pieces. An alternative to that would be Christmas on Mars.
Absolutely.
All right. So really quick here, Flaming Lips primer for a guy who only has one Flaming Lips song that appeared on a compilation CD somewhere.
So first I'm going to note that this will be a lot less music heavy because the film has a lot more going
for it. It's a film about film stuff.
It's got a lot more going for it than this is about the band because it's absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
But the Flaming Lips are this band. They come from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
All right.
Essentially, they're well known for being weirdos.
All right. Yeah, that seems about right.
In recent days, they shot a music video where all of them ran naked through a park.
All right.
That's just part of their thing. They like being strange. They like getting attention. But they try to do it in a really acceptable way, a way that, again, the opposite of what Kiss was in the 70s.
Yeah.
So in the early 2000s, probably around the same time that Detroit Rock City was coming out, Wayne Coyne, the singer of the Flaming Lips, decided he was going to start coming up with a sci-fi movie because he just does what he wants to do. He puts his mind to it and it gets done.
That's a long fucking time ago.
This goes back. Yeah, it is.
It's about 10 years in the making then.
Around this time is when the Flaming Lips started really incorporating a lot of odd, interesting stuff into their stage show. Mm-hmm. The bubble that the green motherfucker crawls out of and into in the beginning and ends of the film.
Yeah.
He actually uses that on shows.
Awesome.
He gets inside it. Security throws him into the crowd. He runs up on top of the crowd for a while. It's a good time. But essentially, Flaming Lips is well known for being artists, less musicians.
Yeah, which we need more of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're well known for having a good time, but without feeling totally comfortable. It's like you're always outside of an inside joke.
Sure.
And the inside joke doesn't have a punchline.
Right.
It's just they're all in something.
I think that's a really good way to describe it, yeah.
They're all in something that you'll never quite be a part of, but you love watching anyway.
Sure.
And that's what this film is.
Just even more of that.
So this film took about 5 years to get made.
To actually physically put together beyond having an idea.
Sure. So it started with an idea in 2001. I think production, in quotes, actually began in 2004.
Okay.
And then it came out last year in 2009. Most of this film was shot in Wayne Coyne's backyard. It was shot.
It's a large backyard.
He lives in Oklahoma City.
Okay,
there's a construction
right.
site behind his house. I'm pretty sure he rented a lot or one of the big warehouses there. But most of the equipment he would go to old construction sites and ask if they were not going to be using stuff. And then they would give it to him because nobody needs extra construction materials.
Tubes. You always have tubes left over
tubes
when you construct things.
A lot of cement cylinders
were
the other thing that he always ended up coming home with.
So what do you build if you have those tools at your disposal?
Well,
a science fiction film
apparently,
is the answer to that.
So that's one of the most enjoyable things about this film is that you have a film that's done totally on your own dime by some new film guy. He has no idea what to do with film.
Yeah, sure. He's like us, really.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even not as well off because he doesn't watch 300 goddamn movies a year.
He brings in the other members of the band to be actors. He brings in his friends. He brings in some well-known actors that he's just tight with. Adam Goldberg.
So this is a good setup. He knows a couple actors. He's got a band full of people. And he has a bunch of construction materials.
Absolutely.
So he says, I'm going to get a camera and make a sci-fi
show.
Sure.
And the best part is that he picks sci-fi over drama, over some of these bullshit indie films. Like, he could easily...
bullshit indie films is a good way to describe that.
He could easily, for the same amount of money, make a really well-produced Me and You and Everyone We Know, where it's just people walking around talking and you put a cute score to it.
Yeah.
And that would be a really effective film. And I think that he could do that really well. That's why I think he picked sci-fi. I think he picked it because it's not safe and because it's something that he has strong feelings about.
Right.
It's clearly inspired by a lot of Russian stuff.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that's, I mean, I don't know if.
A little bit of Solaris. There's obviously, anytime you talk about sci-fi, there's sort of the 2001 stuff.
Right, sure.
2001, A Space Odyssey. And that's some blasphemy right there to call it that. I almost feel like, and I know this is the independent edge, but when we watched Primer, a film that was made for, I believe it was $7,000, really, really low budget, just taking what you can get a hold of and putting it in your film.
Sure.
In Christmas on Mars, all of the sci-fi elements are going to let him be as crazy in front of camera as he wants to be.
Right, exactly.
When there are things that don't make too much sense, they still make a pretty good amount of sense in context. I was expecting this film to be a lot more surreal, a lot more off the wall. And it is, but it does have a pretty clear storyline to it.
Well, the best part of the film is that there's a crutch of people go crazy in space.
Yeah.
So whenever something's happening that doesn't seem like it fits in congruous with
crazy
the story,
people.
There's this constant air of they're just trying to keep themselves from going nuts.
Sure.
And a lot of the thing that's really funny about the film is a lot of the scenes where people are trying to maintain sanity is where color pops in. and obviously very loud noises.
Yes.
But we'll touch on very loud noises after this.
All right.
So the film is done in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you had figured out that, you know, independent film, sci-fi, Russian style, black and white. And
that makes sense. That made sense to me.
But that's because you don't know The Flaming Lips.
Right.
The first thing about The Flaming Lips is that they're ridiculously insane with vibrant color.
All right, fantastic. So everyone went to the film in the way that I went there expecting it to be insane, and it kind of made sense. A lot of people showed up expecting color. They got color in the beginning too, right? And then it went to black and white and everyone was confused.
Yeah.
Wonderfully, deliciously confused.
I absolutely love it. It makes the color scenes almost hurt your eyes and ears. It's just when the
When your ears need a break from bleeding, your eyes start bleeding. Perfect.
When the color comes in, it's huge. It's always a huge moment. And that's because the color scenes are supposed to be the effective scenes that really, they punch you in the face, even if there's not so much going on.
Everything about the movie is huge, which is pretty incredible from an end. You mentioned bullshit indie drama. The reason bullshit indie drama exists is because when you don't have any money, you film people sitting around talking. I mean, there's other reasons that, you know, that is the most prevalent genre of independent productions. But I mean, what are you going to do? If you try to put together a sci-fi film, or at least you would think, it would look like shit. Of course, I just mentioned Primer. So that was a sci-fi film.
Right.
And then there's Christmas on Mars, another science fiction film. So maybe sci-fi isn't a bad genre if you have enough creativity to pull it off.
Right. Well, I also think that it comes off really impressive. I think that low-budget sci-fi is always impressive.
Yeah.
Because of what you're able to do with the little amount of money and production backup that you have. This film is no exception.
Well, when we talked about Primer, I think the most impressive thing about it was how heady it was.
Sure.
How thick the story was. The most impressive thing about Christmas on Mars, as you've noted by the fact we've been talking for a few minutes and haven't started trying to figure out what all of the time parallel crazy stuff means, it's not a film that you can draw charts and graphs and try and dissect the plot of for hours. Instead, it's a film that's almost about basking in that creativity.
Sure.
There is enough in there to make you kind of go, what the fuck was that about? And we'll talk about some of that stuff. But rather than use the usual, I mean, Primer was a great example of someone just being fucking smart enough to put together this story that would take people years to pull apart and try and figure out. Whereas Christmas on Mars was about it's almost set design.
Right.
And incorporating the different elements. It's strange for a first-time filmmaker because it's about the elements of filmmaking coming together in, I think this is a little bold to say, but I feel this way. In a way where a lot of movies don't even get that right. Sound.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, sound. Here's the deal with the sound. This movie is fucking loud.
It is.
And I don't want to just pull out this thing where I say, oh, they're musicians, so they get how the sound works. Because there is another musician friend we talk about all the time on this show who happens to make films, and he puts sound in his movies. But musicians who make films, I mean, that's not a new concept to this show.
Not at all.
But the dynamic range here, I mean, it makes the other films that you and I have been watching in our off hours sound like they have a wet tarp over the sound system.
Absolutely.
It blew the dust out of my speaker. It's crazy how immense and overwhelming, overpowering the sound is.
Well, the whole time we were watching this, you were riding your volume knob.
Yeah, I didn't know what to do.
You were turning it up because sometimes the talking got really quiet and the score would really dull down.
Right.
And immediately, without warning, they would stick their hand in some tube. It would cut to a brain surrounded by rainbows, and it would be deafeningly loud.
Well, and this is going to get a little technical audio-wise, but a lot of audio is very crunched down, especially in films, because you want people to set it to a certain volume.
Sure.
You want them to be fine there. You want them to hear all of the sound effects to know that they're happening. But you don't really, people don't watch movies in headphones. People should watch movies, especially a movie like this one, in headphones, because there's a lot of cool stuff you can catch. If you're the kind of person who watches a movie 100 times, try that movie in headphones. Uh-huh. I think you'll be surprised. But unfortunately, with a lot of films, maybe you won't be surprised because they don't incorporate that kind of dynamic range. The loudest sound you hear is going to be slightly louder than the softest sound you hear in the entire movie.
Sure.
With Christmas on Mars, that range is so, so expansive. I mean, we just watched Detroit Rock City before this. I had our sound system on a normal level that you would have for movies. And the movie starts and it's very loud and, you know, you turn it down a little bit, but the voices pretty much dictate where you need to hear what everybody's saying. So you have moments that are very quiet. You have moments that are just fucking starbursts of audio, and also they're really thick. I mean, the movie doesn't shy away from the low end at all.
Yeah.
The spectrum of audio frequencies is a lot wider than anything you would, than even being close to anything you get in a standard film.
Well, there's a scene in the film, I can't recall which one, where some ridiculously painfully high-pitched sound comes in at, yeah, like the highest end of the bandwidth.
Sure.
To the point where it hurts your, like a television has been turned on, yeah, right next to your head.
Yes.
And then it just gets higher. And it's almost like they're going, we never got up here with our bandwidth, so we'll just try to hit every high frequency we can. We'll just turn this frequency up until your eyes are watering.
Well, you know what?
And then it'll go dead silent.
I don't know if we're thinking of the same particular scene, but I remember maybe a couple times that it gets so high in the register, and you can tell that it's starting from a pretty high frequency and just working its way up. And eventually, you can no longer hear it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm positive that it is still there. It's, you know, it's the frequency only dogs can hear. It's that, like, stupid thing people say.
Right.
We are now at dog whistle frequency. And aside from assaulting your ears, I don't know if I would say that has a purpose, but this isn't necessarily a movie about purpose. It's about creativity. It's about experimentation, doing things that haven't been done before.
Well, the glory of the purpose of this film is that if you know the title, you know what it's about.
Yeah.
The two heaviest themes, aside from getting things done for free and using the only public domain Christmas carol.
Excellent.
Is Christmas on Mars.
You always forget about the song about songs on Christmas.
Yeah, I do.
What was that song?
Sing some songs about Christmas cheer. I don't know. It's a good song. It's a weird Fred Armisen thing that he sings before Silent Night comes in the first time. But the film is about, very much about Christmas on Mars. It's a bunch of people who have been on Mars for a while, and it's Christmas Eve. Steve Androz, the main character, Steve Androz is the guitarist of the Flaming Lips. Also, another thing that you should know is that in the Flaming Lips tunes, he's notoriously for singing ridiculously high, which is why it's funny when he starts singing Silent Night three octaves above Fred Armisen. But it's about him, and he has taken this particular interest in trying to bring some normalcy to the Martian landscape by celebrating Christmas in a traditional style.
Sure.
It's not about Jesus.
Right.
It's not about any of that. It's about the tradition of Christmas in a place where Earth has been almost forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
This comes at the loss of him essentially smuggling Christmas stuff, the Santa suit, some Christmas lights, on board a fuselage that was supposed to be carrying one of the capacitors that they end up blowing out.
Whoops.
So essentially, his obsession, his preoccupation with maintaining the Christmas spirit almost killed everyone on Mars if a new Santa didn't show up.
When you mentioned Christmas not being about Jesus, being about normalcy, I think it's about something else. This is the first time I've seen the film, but I'm going to go as far as to say this might be the first birth given on this colony.
Oh,
we don't
totally.
See any other children around. I don't know if there's a whole lot of other indicators of that, but this birth seems very important.
Right.
Our lead character seems really preoccupied with it. And so, of course, there's the motif of one person dying and another being born, and they go out of the way to point that out. But we're also talking about a birth on Christmas.
Uh-huh.
This process for giving birth on Mars that seems fairly new. Something about plugging things stomach. And
I think it's a weird dynamic supposedly parodying a virgin birth.
Yeah.
Because this woman isn't actually giving birth to the baby.
Right. Well, there doesn't seem to be a father figure around. The colony is just excited about the baby.
It seems like this woman has been put in the giant light bulb in order to care for the baby as a mother. But it's possible, maybe probable, that the baby was formed. It was formed from nothing or formed in a test tube.
But that seems to be their hope for continuing the colony. That's why he talks so heavily about this birth representing hope for all hope for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
As if, you know, if this baby doesn't survive, then nothing is going to survive. And while his high school PE teacher, the captain of the ship, what is this guy's actual, is he captain or do you call the shots? What's he do?
He's the boss. Let's just call him the boss.
All right, boss man. But he is your high school PE teacher, right?
Oh, totally.
Right? Okay. He doesn't seem to believe that this is the last chance for humanity, because it's probably not literally the last chance for humanity.
Well, it's...
They could try again.
Well, and also it seems that Earth may still be going on.
Yeah,
and they're just stuck not being at Earth.
This is just most likely a new process or an important process, even if just for their specific colony, and it's bugging all the characters a lot outside of their usual space delusions. Outside of them being stuck alone in space, isolation, themes that are hit on in virtually every movie about a small colony of people or a single person in space. On top of that, they have to worry about this new facet of their lives. Are they going to be able to, as a colony, really give birth to a child and raise it?
Well, and the other thing that it touches on with isolation that I don't think that too many sci-fi films ever really say or know they're pointing out, but I love it in this film, and it's that they constantly go over the notion that people aren't supposed to live in space.
Sure, sure.
And that's why we don't live in space. Sure. If you want to get really heady, the reason that life has formed on Earth is because that's where life can be.
Makes sense.
That's
sure.
where life lived. That's how evolution works.
We've reached a point in evolution where we are pretty well formed to take advantage of our surroundings. We go somewhere like Mars, and we are not very well adapted for those surroundings. If our capacitor breaks, we're all fucked.
Exactly. Except we have one glimmer of hope, and that's in the form of a green motherfucker played by Wayne Coyne, the director of the film.
Yes.
Who comes down in a loud space bubble that pops out of his mouth and shows up exactly at the right time when the Santa Claus for the Christmas pageant has killed himself in space.
He's had enough of Mars. He just doesn't want to look at any more vaginas.
Absolutely.
Oh, there's vaginas in this film,
everywhere.
By the way. So at first you think, all right, babies. That's the big symbolism here. We're going to talk about babies. There's dead babies. There's smashed babies. And then there's vaginas marching over babies. And you reach a point, and by the end of the film, I think you understand that the baby is a real thing. It's really important to the colony. At first, and this movie just totally throws you, you start out and you get this baby stuff and it's weird and you don't know if you're supposed to be interpreting this as part of the plot. And you're reminded about halfway through that, oh yeah, baby, that's a real thing that's happening in this colony. And then definitely by the end, this is all rooted in reality. It's not rooted in reality is all of the crazy vaginas that are all over the place. So the characters aren't actually seeing vaginas marching through space.
Well, they're actually seeing them, but they're not actually there.
Okay, so this is a result of their space psychosis.
Right.
And all of their preoccupations with this birth problem.
Right, exactly.
Maybe also Wayne's preoccupation with vaginas.
That's also very possible.
Totally possible. I guess I never really performed this thought experiment, but I don't really mind looking at thousands of vaginas in a film.
No, me neither.
Marching around in crazy band uniforms and or holding up dead babies. Yeah. That doesn't really bother me as much as I thought it would.
Well, I think it's kind of like when you pick any random word. My favorite is to pick the word milk and just repeat it till it doesn't sound like a word anymore.
Sure.
I think it's the same thing as when you see vaginas. Normally, it's just one, and you go, oh, I know what that's for. But when you see 15 marching over a baby's head, they lose what they are, and they just become this weird monster head.
Yeah.
And you never want to see a vagina for the rest of the day.
Wow, the rest of the day, that really had a strong impact
on
you, didn't it?
Really fucked me up.
It's this wonderful bit of surrealism, but rooted in a very real psychosis of the character, rooted in a very real problem they're having. So you can have what I would let the film get away with as just complete nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
They just make an entire film about space vaginas. And I would say, all right, it's the Flaming Lips. There's, you know, stuff floating through the air and bursts of color and loud sounds. Everybody's having a fine time. But instead, they use what would be very surreal moments, and they have a purpose in the film. They show you the preoccupation of all of these characters. The first time through the film, I think that's going to probably confuse you a lot more than watching it again.
Right.
I think the second time through the film, it's going to appear very linear.
Absolutely.
And it's totally going to make
sure.
sense. Why? And it's probably going to be even more powerful knowing that all of these characters are worried about. They talk about how they have the same vagina monsters in their dreams.
Absolutely. Well,
the same baby problems.
Another thing that seems really surreal about the film, and this happens towards the end, and I want to dispel this because I think it's a little bit more confusing than it's intended.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout the film, we see a lot of these weird glowing ghost orbs, which are not fucking ghost orbs. They're these little shiny, they look like fireflies.
They're balls of whimsy and wonderment.
And they always fly up to the ceiling.
Sure.
And there's a quote early on where somebody says, the gravity's weird in here.
Yeah.
And everything seems really strange. And that's, I mean, you can attribute that to part of what's going on with people, why they're a little uncomfortable, why things seem off. Partially, that's because they're worried about this birth. But also, it's probably because things are not home. They're not normal.
Yeah.
There's this really beautiful scene, and I love it, at the end of the film. It's the Silent Night scene.
Yeah.
It's the Christmas pageant, where Wayne Coyne is standing there in a Christmas suit, being a great or bad Santa Claus, depending on who you are.
Sure.
And Stephen and Fred Armisen are both singing Silent Night in a beautiful octave harmony. And Michael Ivins, the remaining member of the Flaming Lips, really, the bassist, crawls into this weird room and reaches inside a pink, gooey vagina brain, and pulls out one of those little spinning light things that you can buy at fucking Spencer's Gifts.
Yeah, I love noting all of the, you pointed out the popcorn popper in here, the little tiny hand fans, just the little pieces of, we need a sci-fi device. Yeah, let's head over to Walmart.
So he pulls this out of this brain, and what it seems to do is normalize the gravity.
Yeah.
And all these shiny balls fall down briefly in a scene that is reminiscent of snow.
Yeah.
But it's just these shiny balls, these particles of dust and whimsy that have been floating upward because of the strangeness and gravity. And it all comes to a head at the perfect time, and it's really symbolic of things normalizing in a place where things have never been normal before.
Yeah, you get your brief moment of what's the Martian version of snow. What's as close as they're going to get to snow on their Christmas on Mars.
And it's fantastic.
I really hope people actually watched Christmas on Mars.
I do too. And I hope they watch Detroit Rock City too. Yeah, that's a fun time.
We have 8 films to watch before the show next week.
Yeah, we do.
So we got to get busy. We have a website, doublefeatureshow.com, and an email address, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. We have told you for the first time ever what movies we're doing next time before we're even, you know, we used to hint at that with the Killapaloozas a little bit better because people need time to watch 8 goddamn films.
Yeah.
You know, I almost forgot before we get to that, Sheila, Tim, Allison, Wesley, Tom, and Carrie all sent donations. I was afraid I wouldn't remember all of that. Thanks to our usual donors who keep sending us their money. And thanks to the new recruits. So you know what? This week, everybody just gets to be in the burlesque show because there's a lot of you. And you know what? Our usuals get to be in the burlesque show too. They can take a week off from driving trucks or whatever inane jobs I gave them before. If you want to send us a donation, you can do that by going to donate.doublefeatureshow.com. You will receive a completely free, random, arbitrary, useless sideshow occupation, which has no recognition outside of our show. And we will use your money to help try and place us in the mainstream radio marketplace. Again, that's donate.doublefeatureshow.com. So for the people who weren't paying attention earlier, what are we doing next time?
Next time we're going to cover the Pinhead saga for better or for worse, depending on which film you're watching. But it's the Hellraiser films. All of them. Hellraiser through the 8th Hellraiser, which I believe is called Hellworld. All of the Hellraiser films, which from the first one to the 8th one may make you a little upset.
Then can we watch Mean Girls?
Yeah, we can watch Mean, if you can find something to put it with.
All right, Mean Girls, got to get on that.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.